Hello, I'm Nicholas Barrett.
I'm Marta Dominguez Jiménez.
And I'm Nicholas Potier.
And you're listening to The Sound of Economics. Relations with Moscow have been rocky over the last 6 years as Russia has recoiled from the shock therapy and openness following the end of the Cold War and reverted to a more antagonistic relationship with the West. As a result, we've seen tensions on Europe's eastern extremities, accusations of political interference, and even the spectre of nuclear rearmament. But what might save us, me and you, is if the Russians love their foreign direct investment too. European investment in particular. Nicholas and Marta have been looking into this in a new paper called FDI Another Day, Russia's Reliance on European Investment. So, Marta, to what extent does the Russian economy depend on the European Union?
Well, I think much more than we think and much more that we've internalized. And certainly that has important geopolitical implications. But specifically from a trade standpoint, Europe is about 50% of Russian exports. And European investment is also the majority of investment that goes into Russia with important economic consequences.
So if this relationship stopped tomorrow, Nicholas, what would happen, do you think? I'm going to inconspicuously sip from my Vladimir Putin cup while you answer.
I think it would be very cold for us and very bad for Russia. So it's an interdependence. So we get a lot of our natural gas, a lot of our heating what we use for heating, and also some oil from Russia. But also on the other hand, basically, most of foreign currency that Russia needs to buy all kinds of things come from Europe. So if the music would stop, to say it like this, I think Russia would be in a very big pickle. We would be fine in summer, maybe not so much in winter. But I think the dependence is much more on the Russian side. So Russia relies more on us than we on them.
So this is interesting because obviously many Europeans are aware that we have a kind of energy dependence on Russian gas. And have done for years and years and years. And it would seem that if the Russian economy has a reliance on European investment, that would somehow disincentivize the Kremlin from pursuing a kind of antagonistic foreign policy. But that doesn't seem to have happened. And it seems to be that me that you're suggesting that the Russians don't appreciate quite how reliant they are.
I think the foreign policy that they conducted was very costly to them, and I don't think that is reflected in the media in the way that a Russian foreign policy was. But actually, they had in the last 10 years they had no growth, and they had a huge recession not just like us in 2008, but also in 2014-15. And that was this cost. It was not just caused by the sanction, this was a part, but also by the reliance on oil, and then we had a collapse of the oil price.
Mm. Was it around the time of the Ukrainian annexation and all the sanctions that came with it? Was that roughly around the same time that the oil price went through the floor?
Yes.
Interesting.
Yes, sadly for Russia, everything kind of happened at the same time. The oil price, the currency collapse, the central bank at that point was changing regimes, which did not in the short term benefit the currency collapse very much either. And also, of course, Western sanctions didn't help at all. But I do think there's been a certain dissociation of the economic dependence and the kind of geopolitical actions of Russia. But indeed, the economic consequences of their actions have been significant, although perhaps not as much as they could have been if there had been more of a concerted effort from a European standpoint.
So you've both been working on this paper, FDI Another Day.
you do like the title.
I like the title very much. So what's new in here? What do we know about the actual nature of these investments? What characterizes them?
So I think the main focus of our paper is what actually drives the investments and what is the main focus of investments. And currently, the vast majority of FDI into Russia goes into the oil industry. Not only FDI purely dedicated to mining and quarrying, as it is characterized, but also associated activities, which from the point of view of medium-term growth is not exactly great news for Russia, not only because this is an area that does not typically lead to transfer of technology, et cetera, and kind of additional positive consequences, but also because theoretically we're going green, so.
Yes, that's an interesting point. I mean, I read in the FT a few days ago that European emissions have actually been flat for the last year. And of course, part of the European Green Deal will be about going carbon neutral by 2050, which means that if the Russian economy is as dependent as you say it is on FDI, and most of that FDI is in the fossil fuel industry, then Russia is going to have to reinvent itself in the years to come. Does the Kremlin have a discernible economic strategy?
So I think that's a difficult question to answer. So we had just a big reshuffle of the Russian government. They have now a focus on what they call the national project, which is supposed to be a Canadian stimulus. I'm very skeptical about that. First of all, so they have put now a lot of technocrats into the government, but not knowing too much about the individuals that are now in the government, which is kind of the problem, is that basically they are unknown figures. And it seems to me more like a push by Putin to get out people that could be a threat to him by people that are not. I think one important thing which should I think keep in mind, there's like different camps in the Russian system. There was the Medvedev camp, or what's called the Medvedev camp sometimes, which is kind of the liberal pro-market, kind of more pro-Western camp. And Medvedev was ousted as a prime minister. I don't know how the new cabinet will turn out.
And indeed, this has been sold as a technocratic reshuffle to focus on the economy on some level. But at the same time, they have kicked out the people with a kind of more liberal economic view. So it's, well, I think the power grab angle is certainly a much more correct reflection of what's happened.
If the Russian government can kind of keep this narrative of constant attack and interference from the outside world going, does that mean it doesn't have to be accountable for its economic performance?
I don't know much if you...
I mean, I think in the medium term, everyone's accountable for their economic performance. You can certainly create a certain national...
It seems like Putin was quite effective at outsourcing the blame for Russia's economy to the West.
Yes, absolutely, and creating a foreign enemy, but I don't think that's absolutely sustainable in the medium term.
And as Marta was saying earlier, the one thing is like they're doing fine now, but what's going on in like 20 years down the road? If Europe really decarbonizes by 2050, a colleague of us, Georg Sackmann, has written a piece on like the energy policy of Russia, and actually there are not much other people that can buy all that gas. There's the fossil fuels they sell to China are from a different region, are with a different network, and you cannot just simply substitute European and energy purchases by Chinese. And there are not many other countries that could buy this kind of stuff. And I think there is kind of, in a country like Russia, so the problem with fossil fuels is it's what's called the resource course. So a country like Russia can extract fossil fuels. They don't really need their water economy, their citizens to do well, to be well educated, to be well connected with infrastructure. It's just enough for the elites if they have access to the fossil fuels and they can extract them and sell them. So this is how kind of the elites are quite of happy, maybe still. But the question, what happens if we decarbonize? Will they still be happy?
And I think that was clearly a trend among many countries around the world in the early 2000s. A kind of commodities boom allowed for what looked like significant growth in countries like Venezuela, for example, who are exporting massive amounts of oil and receiving great quantities of dollars. And it's quite easy for the economy to perform well in that regard, regardless of other underlying policies. And to a certain extent, a similar thing happened to Russia. But it did create an enormous dependence, and other industries, you know, slowly deteriorated. And by the time the oil price collapsed, those industries were already too weak to recover. And in that regard, I think there is little expectation of the oil price reaching the levels it was at before the crisis. I think we're at a new kind of medium-term level, which is certainly not as lucrative. It's under half of what it was at the time.
Mm. Some people might be surprised by the limited nature. Or it means I certainly was surprised by the limited nature of Russia's economic relationship with China. You'd think these two huge countries that share such a long border would be natural partners, seeing as they don't really have any democratic difficulties trading and so on. Why is there so little trade in energy and basically everything else between China and Russia?
I mean, you might think they're natural partners, but they're not.
Even historically, when they theoretically, politically were in the same camp, they definitely did not do very well and even had a minor skirmish.
So what's going on now? Why can't they get it together?
So first of all, there are geography. Yes, they have a long border, but this border is in Siberia. And if you look at where all the economic activity is in Russia or all the people live, it's west of the Ural, so at the European part of Russia. So there was never much economic activity except some resource mining in Siberia. And the same is true in China. All the Chinese action is happening at the sea, at the in the port, in the coastal regions, and there's not much happening inland. Then we have the problem that a lot of the, so we have this Belt and Road Initiative that is like one of the headline policies of China. And it is about developing the land link or part of the Belt and Road Initiative, so the road part and not the sea part, is like developing an economic link over land from China to Europe, pouring massive amounts of money into countries that Russia was part of the Soviet Union, that Russia perceives at their backyard as their geopolitical neighborhood. I don't think Russia is happy about that. So I'm not convinced there.
The other thing we have to think about is ultimately Russia has a GDP that is only just above that of Spain. I mean, realistically, for China, Russia is not an interesting country, not particularly. From an energy standpoint, I think the vast majority of Chinese energy comes from coal, which they produce internally. They also have a bit from renewables, a bit from a series of other things, including oil. Now, oil they also produce externally and export and import, some of it from Russia, but I mean the extent to which Russia powers Chinese energy is very, very minor.
But why does Russia, a former superpower with hundreds of millions of people, have an economy on par with Spain?
That's a difficult question. So
talk about communism. Or
yeah. So I mean, I don't want to, because this is a huge question. Not to get too much into the weeds here. But I think parts of it that the Soviet Union was always a bit over, probably was always a bit economically was like there were talks in the 70s and 60s and 80s that Soviet Union will become bigger than US that never bore out. And I think that was probably an overestimate of the Russian productivity or the Soviet Union productivity. Soviet Union was always a structure, kind of a reverse colonialism, or in the classical empires, you have that the center is kind of the manufacturing hub, and then the peripheries are providing the primary resources. Soviet Union was always the opposite. So high value added was not happening in Russia, but often in more like peripheral countries, parts of the Soviet Union. So and then it was a huge financial crisis. We had a huge crisis after the end of the Soviet Union, and
yeah. I think the transition is very badly managed. The Russian economy pretty much collapsed in the 90s. And I think arguably there was an opportunity, a very big opportunity in Europe at the time, indeed, to invest much bigger than the one we have now. Now I think we can still play a role, but at the time probably would have been the, should have been the big investment push from a European standpoint. Also from a solidary angle to some degree, but that did not happen at the time at all.
So this paper that you've written, let's say it does really well, it's very successful. Partly in thanks to yourselves, partly thanks to the amazing skill and determination of the Bruegel communication team. Let's say that Russia suddenly comes to appreciate its reliance on European FDI. What do they do with that information? How can they have a better relationship with Europe? Or perhaps a less dependent relationship with Europe if they should aim for such a thing?
So I think one of our findings is, which is we really point out to which extent not just European, so the biggest investor, so the biggest, most money comes from Europe, but then it's also a lot of Russian money goes through Europe. So because we have very, very low levels of property right protections within Russia, basically Russian oligarchs do not trust the Russian state to protect their interests. A lot of their money is actually channeled through European countries to go back invest into Russia. So I think this is something to keep in mind. And I think
so what you're saying is this is Russian, concentrated Russian wealth bouncing off Russia and coming back in.
Yes,
exactly.
Partly.
And indeed, Cyprus is, I think, the second largest European member state in terms of investment in Russia, which I think from a genuine FDI standpoint is highly unrealistic. And the other thing is FDI flows are typically quite long term. So if you look at, let's say, we're talking about kind of a genuine investment. But yet, if you look at FDI flows in Russia, there is a lot of in and out within the same year, which means kind of yearly values don't reflect the degree of volatility.
So why is it coming in and out so quickly?
Well, precisely because European capital markets, I think, are being used to channel investment by certain sections of the Russian elites.
And I mean, not to be mistaken here, it's still, if you, so this is not genuine FDI, this is kind of just Russian capital bouncing back. If you subtract that from the figures, still Europe is by far the biggest investor. So it's still 50% roughly genuine FDI is from Europe.
And not just that, but I mean, that one that bounces off from Russia is by construction, not FDI. Yeah. So 50% from Europe, but that's the case if you include the one that is from Russia. So it would be even a little bit more.
So coming back to my question, what kind of relationship do you think the Russian government should be seeking with the European Union?
Well, I think part of what they're trying now is more of an autarky-like approach, which I personally see little potential in that. And indeed, there was an FT article some weeks ago saying that on some levels, sanctions have been positive for Russia. Now, this was they were fairly circumspect in their analysis, and they do say it's something few economists think. But I think on some level, it has led to a diversification from oil, which, well, it's what we're advocating in our paper, just not necessarily without foreign capital and without, you know, external economic relations. But also, I think a certain degree of fiscal discipline and so on has resulted from a Russian attempt to not depend as much on foreign capital.
Yeah, and I think the long term, I very much agree with what I just said. And if you look at the long term view, I think when you want to develop, if you're like a middle income country like Russia, and you do want to develop your economy, you have to go beyond resource extraction. And then if you look at what FDI can provide is basically knowledge transfer. So you have a European company coming in, they go stable factory there with their know-how, they send their manager, they train your people, they show how you... And this kind of generates spillovers, generates industry clusters, it generates all kinds of interlinks, and this is basically where you can grow. Resource extraction is just so much you can do. So I think what you would actually want to see is the Russian economy a bit cleaning up their fiscal side, which they already did quite a lot, but also just opening up for trade, kind of their foreign adventures, to put it like this, they have cost them a lot of, they are basically quite isolated at this point, which is like in the end they would want to trade. They're in a good geographical position for manufacturing for Europe. But since it's really difficult for European to invest there because property rights, security is low, border compliance is very, very long, 7 times the cost for European country for imports, 17 times for exports, 17 times for imports, very low FTI, very few free trade agreements. They're not really integrated. And I think what if they would trust our judgment, they should try to diversify in this regard.
And some in the EU have been advocating a closer relationship with Moscow to kind of bring it in from the cold, as it were. Do you think before that happens, I mean, we can talk about what European policymakers can do to help diversify the Russian economy other than just layer on new sanctions, maybe a more friendly approach. But before that can happen, does there need to be some kind of Moscow has to indicate that it's willing to change the way it operates on the global stage before Europe can actively seek to have a better economic relationship?
So this is a very political question. I will try to avoid it a little bit. I think in the end, this is a question that is up to the European leaders. Personally, I wouldn't want to do a podcast about Russia without mentioning that I think, in my humble opinion, Russia is very much to blame. They broke a lot of for the crisis. They broke a lot of international norms. They're not a benevolent actor towards Europe, and I think we should be very careful in kind of treating it that way.
And then again, at the same time, and I'm not necessarily defending this view, but there is a view to be taken that we're predisposed to judge Russia particularly harshly, or that NATO was constructed to fight the Warsaw Pact or to provide an equilibrium in that regard. And so I think psychologically, maybe Russia's actions are judged in a different way, because realistically, we do have relations with many powers who don't respect either international law or human rights internally, let's say. Now, I'm not necessarily advocating for a kinder relationship with Russia or even closer ties, but I do think there is an argument to be made that we are predisposed to see Russia as the enemy.
I mean, just because somebody's acted in a kind of hostile way, well, just because a country's acted in a hostile way in the past doesn't mean it has to be like that in the future. So if Europeans were going to try and make a deal in good faith, some kind of economic new settlement, what do you think that ought to look like?
I mean, geopolitics do have to come into it in that regard. But I think the EU also has some soul searching to do in terms of what it wants to do geopolitically.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. It's smart to say. It's like, in the end, the countries, Russia is what it is, and I don't think it will change. And there's many countries that that have difficult human rights track records and this kind of things, and we still trade with them. I think the takedown for me from this whole project is that we can be very confident at the seat at the table. I think we show how reliant Russia is on European investment. If you look forward, I think if Europe decarbonizes, Russia needs more investment in different sectors than they do now. And I think if we would kind of come with this to the table, I think there's a lot positive that can be achieved if Russia and Europe work together. And I think this is also, say, on the other hand, if there's more escalation, I think there's a lot that Europe can do to protect its interests.
It's interesting. Oh, no, go on.
Sorry. And the other thing I was going to say is that there's now much talk about deindustrialization and so on and automation. And realistically, the path to, let's say, economic development through manufacturing is not going to last 100 years. Mm. And the outsourcing of certain manufacturing activities is something that will gradually be reduced throughout time. So there's definitely an expiry date on this.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because when people talk about the European Green Deal, some people criticize it as being kind of naive because Europe could go to all this trouble, which is just ignored by a lot of the rest of the world. But by having this kind of new emphasis on decarbonization, it can actually make a significant difference to some of our neighbors and the way they write their own economic policy. So there's something to think about there. And in many ways, perhaps Europe has more leverage than it thinks it does. So I guess that's the takeaway. Marta, thank you very much for joining us.
Tsar
Nicholas, always a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
And thank you very much for listening. We'll see you next time. Thank you for listening to The Sound of Economics. And if you want to read the paper, FDI Another Day, you can read it at Bruegel.org. This podcast was presented by me, Nicholas Barrett, and edited by Tiago Almeida, and brought to you by the Bruegel think tank in Brussels. To read our papers and blogs, you can visit Bruegel.org. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you can subscribe on Spotify and iTunes, where you can also leave us a review and let other people know that we exist. And you can stay up to date with everything we do by following us on Twitter at Bruegel_org. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you next time.